from Storyflow. This is your daily audio brief for July 4th. Mason, July 4th. Quick read on what moved overnight. 5 stories. No fluff. Let's get into it. First, from Fast Company. What chronic illness taught me about running a leaner, smarter business. Hustle culture is built on the toxic lie that the human body is an unlimited resource. In the entrepreneurial world, we are conditioned to believe that success is directly proportional to how much sleep we sacrifice, how many fires we personally extinguish, and how hard we can push through physical exhaustion. But when you live with a chronic illness, that math breaks down completely. Your cellular composition doesn't care about Q4 targets, shifting algorithm metrics, or client deadlines. It forces a hard boundary. I know because I tried to fight against this reality. In 2015, while still a college student, I was diagnosed with Graves' disease and hypothyroidism. The diagnosis was a huge physical and emotional setback, but instead of slowing down, I did exactly what the dominant business culture told me to do. I doubled down. A year later, I founded my digital marketing agency, BDY Consult, and spent 5 years fulfilling dozens of client contracts all by myself. Running headfirst into the grind, fueled by equal parts ambition, denial, pure adrenaline, and fear that my health condition would be a professional liability if I admitted it to anyone. But all this pushing caused my thyroid to deteriorate into a severe, chronic condition. Within a single year, I had to undergo major surgery twice to remove the organ. Suddenly, the engine running my business, my own physical body, was out of commission. BDY Consult was thrown into jeopardy, forcing an existential question: how does a business survive when its founder physically cannot show up? That crisis became my turning point. It forced me to abandon the hustle myth and embrace an operational philosophy I call involuntary essentialism. Healthy founders often view operational efficiency as an optional optimization strategy, something to implement when they finally have downtime. For chronically ill founders, essentialism is a mandatory survival mechanism. I didn't choose to streamline my business. My health forced me to strip away everything that didn't absolutely move the needle to save my company and my well-being. I had to transition from a reactive operator into a strategic guardian. Today, I manage a multi-entity career, operating an agency for a decade, teaching digital marketing as an adjunct professor, and expanding my family's African grocery store business into corporate catering markets. This output is not a triumph of grinding, but a proof of concept for systematic efficiency. I used remaining revenue to hire a lean, specialized team, transforming my role from the product to the architect. For any task that did not require my specific executive judgment, I mapped out a standard operating procedure SOP to hand it off immediately. Granular execution tasks that used to drain my day, like copywriting, campaign asset creation, and daily client communications. Here is the strict infrastructure of boundaries and systems that helped me do that. The most critical step in protecting your health is working yourself out of the daily fulfillment pipeline so you can focus entirely on high-level strategy. Once my personal billable hours were decoupled from agency output, the business stopped stalling when my health required me to step away. Today, I act as a generalist project manager focused on macro operations, business growth, and client acquisition, while my team of specialists executes the technical deliverables for my health needs. This transition has been profound. Because stress and overexertion can exacerbate thyroid conditions and affect my physical stamina, stepping out of day-to-day fulfillment keeps me out of the high-stress, unpredictable cycle of extinguishing daily client fires. Shifting my focus to high-level architecture allows me to protect my physical well-being while ensuring the agency continues to grow sustainably. Many founders treat delegation as an expensive luxury or a loss of control. In reality, staying embedded in delivery tasks creates a single point of failure. When your physical energy is capped by a medical condition, you need a visual system to prevent cognitive overload. I redesigned my schedule using strict visual boundaries on Google Calendar, color coding commitments by energy expenditure rather than just topic. I assign red to high priority, non-negotiable energy expenditures like live university lectures or active client pitches, orange to intermediate operational tasks like team syncs or content strategy mapping, and green to low priority administrative tasks. At the start of each week, I review my calendar. If a single day contains an overlapping cluster of high-energy colors, I reschedule them immediately. Do not wait until you feel exhausted to protect your time. Instead, use a visual dashboard to catch unsustainable scheduling patterns before they trigger a physical setback. Hustle culture thrives on constant presence, from Slack messages to quick syncs and emergency Zoom calls. Next, second, from Entrepreneur, how I went from side hustle to seven figures in 12 months using four AI tools, no employees, no investors. Seven-figure revenue in 12 months, that's the headline, and it came from swapping patchwork AI fixes for an AI-first workflow. The author stripped out legacy processes, then rebuilt the business around four core tools: a content generator, a marketing automator, a sales assistant, and an operations manager. By letting each AI handle its specialty, they eliminated the need for hires or outside capital, and the whole system scaled without bottlenecks. The takeaway? If you're still bolting AI onto old habits, you're likely leaving growth on the table. Start by mapping your core tasks, then pick one AI to own each, and let the rest fall into place. Up next, third, from Bloomberg Markets. Ebola vaccine trials could start this year. A candidate Ebola vaccine could start human trials by the end of the year, according to IAVI chief executive. The push comes as case numbers climb in the Democratic Republic of Congo and Uganda, where the rare Bundibugyo strain is resurfacing. Developers are fast-tracking their programs, hoping the new trial will generate data before the next seasonal flare-up. If the early-stage study shows safety and an immune response, it would clear the way for larger efficacy trials later in 2025. The urgency reflects both public health concerns and the broader push to have a ready-to-deploy vaccine stockpile. For now, the focus is on enrolling participants and gathering the first signals of protection. And then, fourth, from Inc.com, if you're sitting down, your cancer risk may be going up. A new study links prolonged sedentary behavior to higher cancer rates, but desk-bound workers and couch potatoes can reduce that risk by 12% by breaking up long periods of inactivity with light movement as simple as a short walk or housework. Next, fifth, from Zero Hedge, first $1 billion, now $50 million, Khanna says wealth tax must not stop at billionaires. Rep, the tax should not stop at billionaires, it must reach centimillionaires, Khanna writes, before spelling out exactly what that means. Every fortune of $50 million and up, hit with a 2% federal levy on wealth above that line every year, forever on top of everything else you al. Ready pay. Ro Khanna DC lay fresh off endorsing California's November ballot measure to seize 5% of billionaire wealth, published a Substack essay Wednesday titled, No Really, Why I Support a Billionaire Wealth Tax. He makes it roughly a dozen paragraphs before explaining that it isn't one. The vehicle is Elizabeth Warren's Ultramillionaire Tax Act, which Khanna notes he has co-sponsored every single year it's been introduced. Former Microsoft executive Steven Sinofsky summed up the reveal in 8 words, just like that, no longer a billionaire's tax, just like that, no longer a billionaire's tax. Link in description. pic.twitter.com/xg0vp. Then K6W Steven Sinofsky at Stevesy July 3, 2026. Pirate Wire's Mike Solan, I was less diplomatic, characterizing the scheme as an annual asset seizure in which the government tallies everything you own and demands a cut on top of your existing tax bill, now openly targeting anyone worth $50 million. His prediction for where the ratchet stops, this ends with your 401k. Khanna's billionaire wealth tax, which is not a tax but an asset seizure in which he tallies everything you own, then demands a percentage asterisk on top asterisk of what you're taxed every single year, is already targeting anyone worth $50 million or more. This ends with your 401k. Link in description. pic.twitter.com/ih9vxcbxkg. Mike Solana at Mixlana July 3, 2026. For those keeping score at home, the threshold discourse has traveled a long way in a short time. The measure headed to California voters in November is a one-time 5% tax on the state's roughly 250 billionaires. And before anyone reaches for the estate planner, Khanna wants the levy to pierce irrevocable trusts with the tax bill to the grantor who set them up, because parking a fortune in a trust, in his telling, shouldn't take it off the government's books. Newsom opposing it countered on June 26 with a national billionaires tax which, in its original form, applied to anyone worth $100 million or more. Language that was quietly scrubbed after multiple outlets quoted it as we reported. 6 days later, Khanna planted the flag at $50 million. None of this is exactly new, of course. The Warren bill has carried the $50 million line since she rolled it out in 2019, and Biden's 2022 billionaire minimum income tax kicked in at $100 million households. The branding always says billionaire, but the fine print iOS a slippery slope. The creep shows up in the sponsor's own math. When the bill debuted, backers said it touched the top 0.05% of American households. The 2026 Wreath introduction, per the same C. Zucman analysis the sponsors tout, now reaches 260,000 households, the top 0.15%. Then there's inflation. The bill's $50 million threshold is a flat statutory number that hasn't moved since 2019, meaning inflation has already quietly cut the real threshold by more than a fifth. Same words, triple the coverage, 5 years. Asset inflation does the broadening automatically. Congress just has to sit still. The escalator, meanwhile, is pre-drafted. Buried in the bill is a provision doubling the top rate to 6% automatically in any year that qualifying trigger legislation is on the books. And anyone curious where a normalized wealth tax eventually settles can consult the countries that already normalized one. Norway's kicks in around $160,000 of net worth. The Netherlands taxes deemed returns on assets above roughly €57,000. The slippery slope is quite literally the only way these things work. Kana spends a portion of the essay taking intramural shots at Newsom, dismissing the governor's version as an income tax billionaires will never feel since they take no salary, borrow against their stock, and pass fortunes t. owe their kids without selling a share, while boasting that he and Bernie Sanders tax the wealth itself, to the tune of a claimed $4.4 trillion. Swiss cantons start in the low six figures. The European wealth taxes that stayed rich only France, Sweden, Germany, Austria, Denmark were repealed as revenue duds. The ones that survived did so by reaching the middle class. The replies were not kind. Christopher Rufo suggested Washington recover the estimated $500 billion a year lost to fraud before inventing new revenue streams. The most like response, from James Hafner, noted that the essay's philosophical case never actually argues its one low-bearing premise that one man's need constitutes a claim on another man's property. Up next, 6, from Zero Hedge, would the founders still recognize their republic? Authored by Andrew P. Napolitano, which is better to be ruled by one tyrant 3,000 miles away or by 3,000 tyrants 1 mile away? Rev. Mather Biles 1706-1788. Does it really matter if the instrument curtailing liberty is a monarch or a popularly elected legislature? This conundrum, along with the witty version of it put to a Boston crowd in 1775 by the little-known colonial era preacher with the famous Uncle Cotton Mather, addresses the age-old question of whether liberty can long survive in a democracy. Biles was a loyalist who, along with about one-third of the American adult white male population in 1776, opposed the American Revolution and favored continued governance by Great Britain. Many of us who monitor federal excess are fearful of out-of-control democracy, which is what we have in America today, yet there remain in our federal structure a few safeguards against runaway federal tyranny, such as the equal state representation in the Senate, the Electoral College, the state co-control of federal elections, the remnants of state sovereignty, and life-tenured federal judges and justices. He didn't fight for the king or agitate against George Washington's troops. He merely warned of the dangers of too much democracy. Of course, the Senate as originally crafted did not consist of popularly elected senators. Rather, they were appointed by state legislatures to represent the sovereign states as states, not the people in them. Part of James Madison's genius was the construction of the federal government as a three-sided table. The first side represented the people, the House of Representatives. The second side represented the sovereign states that predated the federal government by surrendering limited powers to it, the Senate. And the third side manifests the nation-state, the presidency, which is both head of state and head of the executive branch of the federal government. The judiciary, whose prominent role today was unthinkable in 1789, was not part of this mix. In his famous bank speech, Madison argued eloquently against legislation chartering a national bank because the authority to create a bank was not in the Constitution and thus was retained by the states and reserved to them. In that speech, he warned that expansion of the federal government would trample the powers of the states and also the unenumerated natural rights of the people that he would soon protect in the Ninth Amendment. Had Madison been alive during the presidency of the anti-Madisonian Woodrow Wilson, who gave us World War I, the Federal Reserve, the administrative state of government by experts, the popular election of senators, the judicially sanctioned suppression of political speech, and the federal income tax. He would have recoiled at a president destroying the three-sided table. Madison gave the bank speech in February 1791, 11 months before the addition of the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments to the Constitution. Given the popular fears of a new central government, Madison assumed that the Bill of Rights would be quickly ratified. He was right. Wilson did that by leading the campaign to amend the Constitution so as to provide for the direct popular election of senators. Part of Madison's genius was to craft anti-democratic elements into the Constitution as well, and some of them, like state sovereignty, created laboratories of liberty, since some states protect more personal liberties than the Bill of Rights does. President Ronald Reagan reminded the American public in his first inaugural address that the states formed the federal government, not the other way around. Had I been the scrivener of that speech, I'd have encouraged him to add, "And the powers that the states gave to the feds, they can take back." Of course they can. Reagan also famously said that we could vote with our feet. If you don't like the over-the-top regulations in Massachusetts, you can move to New Hampshire. If you're fed up with the highest state taxes in the Union in New Jersey, you can move to Pennsylvania. But the more state sovereignty the feds absorb, the more state governance is federalized, the fewer differences there are among the regulatory and taxing structures of the states. This has happened because Congress has become a general legislature without regard for the constitutional limits imposed on it. Thus, it offered hundreds of millions of dollars to the states to lower their speed limits on highways and to lower the acceptable blood alcohol level in people's veins. This would truly have set Madison off before a presumption of DWI may be argued, all in return for cash to pave state maintain D highways. If Congress wants to regulate an area of governance that is clearly beyond its constitutional competence, it bribes the states to do so with borrowed or Federal Reserve-created cash. The states are partly to blame for this. While in the U.S., the government's periodic bans of the latest model from Anthropic, which has made a idumerism in hopes of getting the government to regulate everyone else except Anthropic, yet repeatedly achieving just the opposite into an art form, has been all the rage in recent months. In China, it is the other way around, with China's tech giant Alibaba banning employees from using Anthropic's Claude code at work after the tool drew scrutiny for features that can help identify China-linked users, Reuters reported. They take whatever cash Congress offers, and they accept the strings that come with it. And then, 7th, from Zero Hedge. Alibaba bans employees from using Anthropic's coding tool over distillation scandal. The ban is part of a deepening spat between the two companies after Anthropic accused Alibaba of illicitly extracting its Claude AI model capabilities, a dispute that highlights the frantic race between the US and China to take the lead in artificial intelligence. Claude Code is Anthropic's AI coding assistant for software developers and has become popular among programmers in China despite Anthropic's restrictions on access by users and entities in China. To avoid further escalation of the distillation scandal, Reuters says that Alibaba employees were being told to use the company's own coding platform Coda. As we reported at the time, in late June, Anthropic said that it had suffered a strike by Alibaba, which it described as a distillation effort that involves training a less capable model on the outputs of a stronger one. The distillation helps accelerate China's ability to reach Anthropic's advanced Mythos preview capabilities, the company alleged in a letter sent to two US senators. Alibaba's ban comes just days after developers said Claude Code contained mechanisms that inspected user environments, including time zone and proxy-related information, and inserted subtle markers into prompts sent to Anthropic's servers. An Anthropic employee wrote on Tuesday on X that the feature was an experiment we launched in March intended to prevent account abuse by unauthorized resellers and protect against model distillation. The person who spoke to Reuters about Alibaba's ban said that Anthropic's restrictions targeting China were difficult to enforce on individual users who can deploy servers in the United States and make traffic appear as if it originated there, but companies were now more aware of legal and compliance risks. As US AI model developers seek to prevent unauthorized access, resale, and distillation of their systems, Chinese cloud and AI firms have shifted toward domestic and open source models such as DeepSeek. Alibaba's Qwen, Moonshot and Jipu. At the same time, Chinese AI models are making inroads in the US market, a development that sparked concern among some US industry experts, since China's models are about 90% cheaper yet perform just fractionally worse than the latest US frontier models. All the celebrities spotted at Taylor Swift's wedding at Madison Square Garden. Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce celebrated their wedding with hundreds of celebs in New York City. Amid high security, photos show famous guests heading to Madison Square Garden. Jason Sudeikis, Hugh Grant, Benson Bo, One, and Ethan Hawke were among the attendees. We discussed this extensively in one of our flagship reports, answering the trillion-dollar question, are China's AI models a better value than US models? The answer, judging by the rapid token transition to China, is a resounding yes. Next, 8th, from Business Insider. Hundreds of famous people flocked to Midtown Manhattan in the midst of a heat wave in honor of America's biggest power couple. Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce were officially wed Friday night, Madison Square Garden in New York City, the Associated Press reported. The star-studded event was officiated by Adam Sandler. Swift's brother served as her man of honor, and Kelce's brother Jason was his best man, according to the AP. Early Friday morning, the streets around the venue, including portions of bustling Penn Station, were closed to traffic and pedestrians. Throughout the afternoon, a long line of black SUVs ferried attendees through a privacy curtain into the venue, as a small crowd of Swifties lined up for a glimpse. By 8 p.m., the marquee outside MSG confirmed Just and T married in bold lavender LEDs. "It's a love story," proclaimed the arena's official account on X. Here are some of the celebrity guests confirmed at the wedding celebration. This is a developing story. Please check back for updates. Read the original article on Business Insider. Up next, 9th, from Metal Sand Miners. The end of Sticky Capital, the biggest hedge fund tech sell-off since 2016, and the rotation that will follow. For the better part of 15 years, the United States technology sector has been the ultimate safe haven for institutional capital. Hedge funds, pension funds, and retail investors alike have treated mega-cap technology stocks as sticky, buy-and-hold investments. The prevailing wisdom was that these companies possessed impenetrable moats, infinite growth potential, and the ability to weather any macroeconomic storm. However, the data is now signaling a massive structural shift beneath the surface of the market. The smart money is quietly heading for the exits. According to recent prime brokerage data from Goldman Sachs, hedge funds have just executed the largest weekly offloading of United States information technology equities since the firm began tracking the metric in 2016. This wave of selling during the week ending June 25th was not a minor portfolio rebalancing. It was a violent liquidation that exceeded the massive tech sell-off witnessed in August 2024, when the Nasdaq 100 plunged into correction territory. In fact, it represents the most aggressive institutional selling of domestic equities since the infamous Liberation Day market rout in April 2025. The implications of this institutional exodus are profound. The concentration of the Magnificent Seven stocks as a percentage of total United States hedge fund exposure has plummeted to just 14.5%, hovering near a three-year low. This represents a massive 7% point decline since the beginning of 2026, marking the sharpest six-month reduction in exposure since the brutal bear market of 2022. The era of technology stocks serving as permanent, sticky capital sinks is officially over. We are entering a new regime defined by rapid capital rotation, and an upcoming major beneficiary will be the physical commodities required to build the future. The record liquidation, hedge funds just sold the largest amount of United States information technology equities in a single week since data collection began in 2016. The exposure collapse, institutional exposure to the Magnificent Seven has dropped to near three-year lows, declining by 7% points in just 6 months. The end of sticky capital, the technology sector is no longer viewed as a permanent buy and hold investment, signaling a shift toward more frequent and aggressive capital rotations. The next destination, as capital flees the overvalued technology sector, it will inevitably rotate into deeply undervalued, strategically critical hard assets. The historical precedent, given the severe supply deficits in strategic critical metals, the coming rotation is likely to rival the massive commodity bull markets of the 1930s, 1970s, and early 2000s. The end of sticky capital, the biggest hedge fund tech sell-off since 2016, and the rotation that will follow. So, let's dig in and then. 10th, from Krista Kyle and Friends. Is Blue Texas here? For episode 285 of Crystal, Kyle and Friends, we took this opportunity, a watershed moment in American politics with recent and forthcoming elections for progressive candidates, to talk to David Griscom. He's an expert on Texas politics and an insightful commentator on left electoral politics, and we've brought him on the show to talk Texas elections, the history of radicalism in a state to which MAGA politics are always ascribed, and so much more. Watch below. That's the read. Watch the tape. Ignore the noise. Back tomorrow.